High Attainable Listeners. Today, we are talking with Erin Hahn, co-owner of LA's sustainable fashion store and brand, East West Shop. Erin started the business 4+ years ago with her husband and business partner, Dennis Hahn, who, like Erin, came from the corporate fashion industry. Together, Erin and Dennis have successfully created a community-driven fashion brand here in LA. They find inspiration from defining their own modern streetwear looks using vintage, overstock, dead stock, and recycled materials, which you will see turns up some major creative heat when it comes to the relationships they've forged and the community they've built. Erin is super knowledgeable in both the fashion industry and the sustainable fashion space, and she's an innovative creator overall. I'm excited to jump into this conversation. Let's go. Erin Hahn.
Hello.
Hi, welcome to the Attainable Podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And you are in the fashion industry, which is notorious for being one of the most unsustainable industries across the world. But together with your husband, Dennis, you are pioneering your way to carve out a sustainable path and a sustainable model for the fashion industry to follow. So let's learn a bit about why you started in the first place. You were in fashion before opening East West Shop. What originally interested you about the fashion industry, and why did you get into fashion in the first place?
Oh man, that goes deep. That goes back to just how I was raised, to be honest. When I was young, when I was about 5 years old, my mom taught me how to hand embroider. And that was kind of our thing we did together. And my mom's always been a sewer. She's actually retired now, and she's a quilter and a knitter, pretty seriously. So she taught me how to sew when I was really young, and I liked that I could make things for myself. Like if I didn't like something the way that it was, I could make something new out of it. When I originally got into the industry, the fashion industry, I explored other things that I wanted to do with my life. And then when I started taking clothes on fashion design and learning the industry behind making clothes, it was one of the first times I felt really engaged in what I was learning, and I just wanted to learn more.
Having been in the fashion industry and starting East West Shop, you and your husband, Dennis, what really was the reason why you wanted to start your own shop together? And did it stem from wanting to see current fashion industry practices change or help our planet, or from something else?
Basically, I won't give you the whole backstory on all of it, but one of my last trips over to China, I traveled a lot for work. I used to go to Asia a couple times a year for a long time, and I would visit factories, and you know, all the factories we worked with were like family to me. They were all really amazing people. We really had some great factories. But my last trip to China, the air quality was so bad, I couldn't breathe. I was walking like a couple blocks and I lost my breath, I guess kind of like somebody with asthma might feel. And the air quality then was over 300 or around 300. The air quality index, which lately with the fires, like I think in LA, it's actually really bad right now. And it's at about 150, the air quality index, because there's no wind and the bad air is just sitting over the city. But that's only half of the amount of particles that were in the air when I was in China at that time.
On a normal day.
Yeah, that was just like a normal day. And I went to lunch with my factories and I was like, you know, how do you feel about this? And they were like, well, we wish our kids saw the sun more, but that's just kind of how it is here. And I just had like a realization that most Americans, obviously 100%, their pollution is not only because of fashion, but at the same time, it made me feel this like, man, we're creating a mess over here in so many ways that no one has to see or experience. It was hard to even explain it. I just left China that trip with like a really, really sad feeling in my heart. And actually the air quality did clear up while I was there because Obama came to town to talk about air quality and all the factories shut down which was why the air quality was so bad before.
Closing for a day positively impacted.
Yeah, it positively impacted, which was another thing that I like made a correlation in my mind. Like, okay, this is directly impacting these people's quality of life. By the time you fly over to Asia enough times, you realize that we all share the same air, you know, like it's not that far, you know, right. It's far, but it's not that far. Like we all globally share the same air. We share the same water. It constantly recycles around. And so it was just like a really, really bad feeling I had. And then when I got back, I coincidentally met a man who, he had a thrift store, but it was attached to a rag house, like a sorting facility for vintage clothes that don't sell at Goodwill or Salvation Army or anywhere else. They go into a back cycle, which I found out since only about 10 to 20% of what we donate goes into actually sells in the stores, and then the rest go into this cycle. And he had so much good clothes. I just started buying clothes because I would use them for reference or I'd give them to friends. I was like, my gosh. And I started to see and more of how the back sorting part of it worked. And really what struck me the most was how much there was already there. Mm-hmm. It was kind of like, oh my gosh, we've created a monster. Like there's all this product already out here that needs a new life that shouldn't be dead yet. It shouldn't be at the point where it's going to get shipped across the globe to some other country who doesn't really need it either. It shouldn't be ripped up, like cut up and turned into an industrial rag. It was just created a couple years ago. And now it's already becoming trash. And it was just this like super awareness of we've already created so much. Why don't we use what we have if we can?
And in terms of donating, does that include Goodwill and Salvation Army, those types of donation centers?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All those donation centers. Yeah. They only sell about 10 to 20%. And, you know, some are probably better than others. And some have, like Goodwill's been doing a lot lately to modernize their look. And they have bloggers that come in and all those people that do like a shop with me and on YouTube and stuff. Like, I think they're getting a revitalization in a lot of areas, which is great.
Great, yeah.
Because the more that can sell in that level, the better. It's going towards creating jobs. By the time it gets into the back cycle, those clothes get baled up. So basically they get smushed together. So if you had a beautiful leather jacket before, now it's a wrinkled leather jacket, which may or may not work in its favor.
Mm-hmm.
And, right. You know, the system is a little bit crazy, but for me, it was like, man, we need to work with what's out there when we can.
You assume that, okay, great. You know, it's going to go in the back shop. They're going to, you may brush it off a little bit, put it on the hanger and it's going to go back. But to understand that there's a whole deeper system on the back end that you feel like, okay, these clothes, I want them to go to someone else that can use them, but maybe they'll never, ever see that.
Yeah, they might not. And they might just end up in a trash or they might end up baled up. The things I've seen, I'm like, those are bales of clothes just sitting outside because no one can even get to them because it's too cumbersome.
Wow.
To like take them apart and resort them and then find a buyer for each of them. You have certain markets that will only take certain things. And then you have Central America and South America from the connections that I've seen. Those buyers will take fast fashion sometimes or more modern clothes like Forever 21 and things like that. So those actually do have a little bit of resale value to them. Also think about all the things you've donated because you didn't want to, and I'm not saying you personally, but maybe I am because I'm kind of saying me personally, but all the things we've donated that we donated it because a button fell off, but like we don't want to put the time in to fix the button.
Sure. Yeah.
And so we're like, oh, we'll just donate it. Somebody will want to do it. No, no one's going to want to do it. No one's going to want to do it unless that shirt is a dollar at the thrift store, but you know, they don't even want to deal with that. So then that stuff sometimes doesn't even make it to the thrift store.
Wow.
So it gets deep.
Yeah, it does.
You know, it gets deep. But like it's a perfectly fixable garment. That's the thing. It's perfectly by environmental standards. And when you think about the environmental cost of making that shirt, it's perfectly fixable. All it needs is a button. As long as the style is good and the style, you know, and the fabric is still good, then it's still a commodity potentially. And that's how I look at it.
Tell us what is your mission and really what are you trying to change and trying to do at East West Shop and how do you source your clothes and giving them this new life?
Well, basically, the whole intention from the very beginning was to be in a community, in a place, in a small location where we could actually interact with people and talk to people. That was really important to us from the very beginning. Like, we wanted to be in a neighborhood, in a community. And coming out of working jobs where we commuted from one county to another county for work, and then sat in an office and basically looked online to see what was relevant and what was going on out there. It was so important for us to be in a space where we could actually interact with people and see where people's headspace was at, and like get inspired by real people, by like real kids out there, not these fake internet views.
Influencers.
Yeah. It was like people present their best online, so it's different. But most designers these days, that's what they're doing, because they're working their butts off to like keep up everything. And most people find most of their inspiration online, whether it's like looking at fashion runway shows or if it's looking at different blogs. And to me, that's exhausting. I want to actually get inspired by real people. My friend Laura, who I met through the shop, who is a baker, we talk about sustainability, and she appreciates what we're doing in fashion. And what she's doing at her job is she's always looking at where's the waste created from this. And she was getting waste from her croissants because they have extra, when they cut their croissant shape, it makes all this extra. So she would save the dough and then remake new pastries on the side on her own, but just so that they weren't wasting the materials. So like people like that are inspiring to me, and people I wouldn't have met if it weren't for the store. The store part of it was definitely important. The space we wanted to create was a place where you walk in and you don't know what's exactly going on. You walk in, you think you're at a boutique. You don't know what's used and what's not used, what's vintage, what's not vintage. Some of it is vintage, some of it's not. Basically, our shop's goal is to use the least amount of environmental resources for everything we have in our store. That's what it's come to in this 4 years. If it's a vintage item, that means it's the best possible thing. If we can find vintage and just put it back into the cycle and not have to create any new resources, that's wonderful. So we wash that stuff and we put it out. But then we also will make shirts out of surplus or leftover materials. I work with a factory in Compton where I go through his warehouse shelves and I try and use the fabric that he has sitting around. So basically, in the past, he would lose money by just off-pricing all these fabric remnants, or fabric that came in the wrong color and it got dumped by the buyer, different things like that. There's just so it all these materials accumulate so fast because it's cheaper to leave them behind than to deal with them sometimes, or at least that's the perception.
Did those fabrics ever find their way to landfill if they haven't been sold or used within a couple of years, or is there ever a time limit where those actually will just then
it
go?
It depends on the fabric and how they're being stored, really. I mean, they would go to an off-pricer, so they might still stay in a market of some sort. Whether that market's going to make a garment out of them that will continue to stay in the... I look at the cycle as not just ending when the buyer of that garment is done wearing it. It's like, can it stay? Can it become vintage one day? For me, that's the goal, is when I create a new garment, I want to try to make something that's going to last for a while. But those fabrics, who knows? It's a combination of things. Sometimes it's easier to just throw things away. Sometimes they get given away. Sometimes they off-price them. It's like a variety of different things. But the nice thing about the way we're doing it is treating it in the sort of a cyclical way with a factory, so that he can plug it in when his factory is not as busy, because my schedule is a little bit different. I'm not selling it. I'm not pre-selling it. I'll just get stuff made when he has time to make stuff for me. It's kind of like a win-win for both of us. And I feel like it's a healthy example of building these little mini cycles. To me, everything's a little cycle. Like, who's the recycler for that? Down to the scraps that we use at his factory, they get picked up by a person who turns them into industrial rags. The whole lot of fabric is now getting used.
Going back to community, there's so much happening locally and so many resources and so many places to source from locally. It sounds like a lot of the practices worldwide are not based on that local model, but your entire shop is based on on, and that's how you build that community, is looking to your community to not only support you, but really build the base for your brand.
Yeah, absolutely. And the more we can keep local, the better, especially when it comes to our waste. Even China and all the countries in Asia have been now refusing our recyclables because we were sending them our trash. And the t-shirts, there was a really awesome Anthony Bourdain show from his last season, and he went to Kenya and he talks to a couple local makers there about their market and how the American vintage cycle has decimated their local textile market. But there's duties and tariffs at the borders, and it's just a really interesting story on there. Basically, they're bullied into continuing to have our imports, even though they don't need them. So why can't we start to become accountable for all the materials we're making? If we're making raw materials, I mean, this is my whole attitude on all of it, is if you're a brand out there and you've decided to develop a new fabric, let's say, or make a new material, be accountable to that material and be accountable to the resources that went into making that material. Think about it. If you put that in your mind and you actually think about, like, okay, well, that roll of fabric, we had to use a lot of pesticides and insecticides to grow that fabric. We used this much water. One t-shirt uses as much water as one person drinks in 2 years. So if you think about it that way, then you become accountable to it and you're like, okay, well, am I going to use every square inch of this fabric if I can? When we use a leather hide, we think of every bit of that leather hide as being valuable, because it is. You can still do something with it. And the same thing is said with fabric, but so much is being thrown away and so much is just not even being thought of. It's been 4.5 years of me really trying to understand this and read some research and meet people that are doing things in the fashion industry to make it better, to really understand. If you think about these things during the design process, it changes everything you do.
Right. And why is the current way there's profit in the least sustainable way? And how can we flip that here, right? Really use all your materials and not have to create more virgin raw materials.
And honestly, the raw materials that are out there that are already created and made are practically free. Like, people are giving it away. And there's tons of it out there. Everyone has to think through that cycle and try to be as wholesome as they can and as earth-minded through the whole process. And not just use an old material and then just destroy it again. Sometimes people will discredit those materials.
I love to hear that Goodwill is being revitalized, the brand, and just the notion of shopping at secondhand stores, consignment stores. When I was growing up and in high school, it was never cool to go to those places because the cool thing was buying new. Like, what's the new, you know, the new trend? You have the brand new sneakers. And so there's a notion and a stigma around musky secondhand. And it's switching that stigma around. And you're doing that through your shop. What you're really doing is remaking these clothes into these pieces that are new.
Right. Yeah, we do that too. There's a lot of different stigmas and especially rooted in lots of different cultures. And I've had some really interesting conversations with customers and friends about that too. For me, my parents every year, I love my parents to death, but they would give me, I love that. But they would give me like a gift card to go to the department store and get new clothes. Cause they were like, why are you wearing all old clothes? So there's that. But then there was also really deep in the Asian community that, you know, we're old stuff. And the way that we were raised in the 80s and the 90s, why would you wear anything used? It should always be new. It should be the newest, greatest, bestest. And I came from the streetwear skate market. That's where, from what I designed before. And my husband was a shoe designer in the skate market as well. And the streetwear market, especially in the United States, is so new driven. It's so like, oh, this is so exclusive, or this is the newest, coolest everything, or I keep my sneakers to look brand new. Like, that's part of the whole culture of it. But the way I see streetwear is like going against mainstream in a way, but at the same time, it's functional clothes. It's what people in the city wear. A lot of my friends who have jobs where they don't sit behind a desk and they're out working, they need workwear. They need modern, awesome workwear. And a lot of the vintage stuff is way more better made than a lot of the new stuff. So if I can find that and help keep people in the city hooked up with clothes they can actually wear for real life, that's what's important to me. And it's not so much of like a scene or like trying to be the newest, coolest, but it's like, hey, you need a cool Carhartt jacket. You can go buy the new one, or you can get this cool old one from the 90s. And it's been washed and it's ready to wear and it actually has a cool patina on it, you know? Yeah. So young people and actually young Asian people are some of our best customers. So it's a different changing mindset from that mindset that everything has to be brand new.
And you bring up quality, and that's one thing I've noticed. My mom has handed me down some jackets from probably the 50s or 60s, very old pieces, jean jacket, and they are such good quality, durable, they're nicely worn. Now we're buying from Gap, let's say. I've bought a couple tops from Gap, and those tops still are with me from high school and it's good material. But now I feel like the clothes that I'm, any fast fashion that I've gotten in the last 2 years, the materials are so cheap and it's so cheaply made and the seams don't line up. And is that just the way that the industry and the fast fashion industry has taken over? Because when you talk about vintage, those are the good quality clothing that's going to last for decades.
Totally.
And now that's not a symptom of our clothing now.
Right. Well, there's a lot of factors in that, but it's, as I see it, it's 100% due to fast fashion and it's due to us training the consumer that the clothing prices wouldn't change at all during that time since the 1950s. You know, it hasn't gone up much. It's the inflation of clothing prices is very, very small. And the only way to make
them
for the same price as the way they used to be, there's some ways you can get cheaper labor, which is why we have moved it all over the world. A lot of it comes down to material costs and also construction. And to be honest, it's a changing of the way they used to make things compared to the quantity of how they're making it now is an astronomical difference. And the way that they used to make, like, let's just talk about Levi's jackets as an example. I don't think they sold or made any Levi's jackets that were already like washed down and worn to look vintage. They were all raw denim. Maybe they had a wash on them, but it's raw denim. The machinery back then was really beautiful too. And they really, it was like an art, the way that they chose the machinery. There was used to be this really great shop called John Harb. It was downtown and they closed like a year and a half ago. I think that the owner retired or maybe, I don't know. Anyway, it was like a museum of machines. It was beautiful. It was like, oh my God, look at all these amazing old machines. But there's still some factories around downtown that have those machines and they'll do small boutique orders, but they're not big bulk machines. Like they had to improve the efficiency of machines with time to be able to sew fast and to sew more garments. So things like a blind hem that they used to do on a lot of t-shirts back in the 80s, like Screen Stars shirts, they used to have blind hems on them, but those machines are slow. So on a production line, that would really increase the cost of the garment to have that stitch. So they're going to use the cheapest, fastest machines that they have. It's a combination of so many different things, to be honest, but also the design intention. Most of the brands that I really love these days are brands that make product that is intended to have second or third lives. Like APC is a good example of that. They sell their beautiful raw jeans and then they have a butler program. So if you're not the kind of person who likes to wear vintage jeans, but somebody else is the person who wants to wear vintage jeans, then you can sell them back your vintage jeans and then get a brand new pair of raw jeans. And somebody else can come in and buy your vintage jeans. They weren't worn down fake. It was worn down by a real human being with time. So it's like finding those little intentions of intentionality in design is really important. It's really what it's all about.
This conversation alone is getting people to think about what they're buying and what's available new to them now, and that is really not the best clothing they're going to get. The best is vintage. Like shop secondhand.
Yeah. Or, you know, when you save your money, like for vintage clothes, you can buy a lot more vintage clothes than you can brand new clothes and really think about the cost per wear, both environmental and monetary cost per wear, and how much wear are you going to get out of that piece? And if it's going to be a shirt that you wear all the time, and if it's going to be your favorite shirt, and then one day when it's getting kind of ratty, you can re-dye it and keep wearing it, then really how expensive is it? Versus like you go to Target and you get a $6 shirt and then you wear it once and you're like, God, I don't even really like this fabric. And right. I already have a hole down here. One of my best friends owns a t-shirt t-shirt line in New York. It's made in New York. They're beautiful shirts. They cost $70. So it's an investment. But her shirts are the first thing that I reach for when I open my drawer. It's like, it fits perfect. The fabric isn't going to wear out. And even one of them, I've already re-dyed it because I got it stained. So it has so many more lives. It's not, it's, if you look at something as a $7 shirt versus a $70 shirt, it's like comparing an apple to an orange. You have to look at like, well, do I even like apples? Like, I don't actually like apples, so they're not the same. Like, the apple might be $2 and the orange is $5, but to me, the orange has more value because I like the orange and I need vitamin C.
That's like an interesting analogy, but it works so well.
Weird, but yeah. Compare things to what they are, not to just like the money that you're being charged for it.
Or what the influencer blogger is telling us we should
buy. Oh my gosh, that especially.
So I want to talk about your dyeing process and what you do and how it's so different and so unique. You recently had a partnership with Sweet Green where you use their salad scraps to dye clothing. Talk to us about using organic plant matter as a dye, and how does that differ from dyes you've previously used, and what has that learning process been like for you?
Well, it's been a really long learning process for me. I started learning about natural dyes probably almost 10 years ago. And even while I was at my previous job, I actually met a woman who was doing them on more of a commercial scale at that time. She was ahead of her time because even it was a tough sell to everyone. It was just going to take a lot more work. So it was like, okay, well, can we justify sending a truck to this woman's house up in a hill to get things dyed just so that it's natural dye? You know, it's like basically natural dyeing is no matter what is a disruption to a system. So even with Sweet Green, it's a total disruption to your system. You have a system of throwing things away when you're done with them, or, you know, in their case, them and also wax paper, who I get a lot of things from. In Chinatown, it's a local sandwich shop. They both send their stuff to compost, which is awesome. It's not going into the trash, which is very cool. But at the same time, like asking them to put aside the onion skins for me or to put aside avocado skins and pits for me, it's not as easy as it seems because everyone's in our systems and like our way of doing things. So that's part of the thing with natural dye. It takes a lot of work. It's definitely a system disruptor and it takes a long time to learn it. There's so much science behind it. There's chemistry involved. There's pH of water. There's different chemical reactions. There's different processes that you have to do to the shirts or napkins or bags before you start dyeing that can alter the color that you ultimately get. And then there's also different tannins or modifiers like iron that you can use after you dye to once again modify the color that you got also. So it's a really intense process. But at the same time, starting with something like avocado is a really nice, easy place for anyone to start if they're interested in natural dyeing, because the avocado has a pit. In the pit, you use the pit of it and use the skin of it, and they have tannins in them. So you don't necessarily, if you're using cotton, and let's say you're doing something like, one of my favorite things to dye is my old towels from my kitchen, because they get stains on them and they don't look very nice. We have a basket full of rags, and that's actually one thing that we tell people about too, because paper towels was our first thing that we got rid of as a family. It's just kind of a little side note. It was so surprisingly easy for us. It was like, we didn't need them anymore. We have a really cool little basket that we keep all of our rags in. Anytime like an old towel gets too dingy then, or an old t-shirt, or if we cut off a piece of a t-shirt or something, it goes in that bin and it becomes a rag. And we got eliminated paper towels that way. And it was like freedom from having to buy paper towels and lug around those giant paper towel things. But it was also, I just felt stupid. Like, why do we have to clean everything up with a tree? Like, why did we have to cut down a tree to clean the counter? The towels, like I'll take them from the kitchen and I'll tie dye them. So I'll like tie them up with some rubber bands or string. And then I'll make a pot. If anything I'm using that I'm dyeing with and I'm done dyeing, I'll throw in some random stuff like that just because it revitalizes my towels and it makes them fun again. But avocado. So avocado is a really great place to start because Basically, all you need is a pot that's not a pot you cook in. And starting with either enamel or stainless steel is always best, not aluminum. You can also use a plastic bucket, like a 5-gallon plastic bucket, and you can put the avocados in and put water and either simmer them or you can lid them and leave them in the sun, which will get moldy and is nasty, but I usually skim the mold and keep going, carry on. But you can dye things just with that. So even if you left a 5-gallon bin out with avocado pits and skins and a little bit of water, it will turn that water to a light pink color and then to like a mauvey brown color. And it'll dye something similar to that, like a nude pink, mauve, pale pink color. Sometimes it's tan. It depends on how hot it gets. So
one thing with dyeing is you never know how it's going to turn out when it comes out.
Totally. Right?
And yeah. I love too that you're playing with color as well. So not only the pattern, but the color.
Yeah, it's fun. Every time you never know what you're going to get. And then that's kind of the fun of it because you can't go wrong. Like they're all earthy colors. They're all really beautiful colors in the long run. And if you just keep layering them on, like if you dye something and then it doesn't turn out quite the way you want it, if you layer something else over it, it becomes a whole new something. And it's a lot of fun. I really like to experiment. I mean, that's ultimately what it is. It's like a huge experiment that hasn't ended.
I'm sure our listeners are curious about what you have coming up. Do you want to tell us about any projects or neat things coming up for you?
Yeah, we're in talks with a lot of different people right now with different possible projects in the new year. And I'm also dyeing some shirts right now for Young Maven, which is a t-shirt line that's based up in the Northwest, but all their shirts are made in LA. And they're made out of hemp cotton blend and they dye beautifully. Ooh. It's like really, really beautiful fabric. So I'm dyeing some stuff right now for them as well. And then we're also expanding some of the knits that we're making in our factory in Compton that are made out of like all leftover materials. We have a really sexy bodysuit coming for holiday.
Oh, cool.
The cool thing is that it gives me multiples of sizes so that I can actually put something online and sell it. I don't put a whole lot of things online because we sell out of it so quickly in the store. So it's like doing the work to put it online to just sell out of it before we actually sell it online is frustrating. So that way we can have some stuff that can be available online also. Also was just given a lot of raw denim. So I have a really beautiful new like raw denim kimono looking jacket coming now too. So there's going to be some other really fun things in the works.
Cool. And where can people find you and your store and you on social media?
So the store is located in Chinatown. We're in the Far East Plaza, which is at 727 North Broadway. We're in Suite 115. It's right in the middle of the plaza. And that's where most of our product is. And on social media is our second most populated place for product because a lot of times when we get new product or if I go down to Compton to work with our rag house where I try and save as many shirts as I can from becoming industrial rags, when I go through those, a lot of times I'll blast the shirts and then I'll sell them through Instagram too. So our Instagram account is east.west.shop. So just east west shop with a dot in between. People DM us and we do ship and it's easy to facilitate transactions through there. And then we have a website, which is east-west-shop.com. And that we're continually updating and putting new things on there of trying to like give sustainable tips and showing the natural dye process. There'll be more updates coming to that in the future. And also hopefully some new product added there soon too. But the best place to buy product is through Instagram.
Okay, awesome. I'm going to look for those bodysuits.
I know. They're so good. I told my husband, I was like, oh no, I'm giving away my sexy secret bodysuit.
Bring it on. Good. Let's do it.
So good. Yeah.
Our final question today, what is one action our listeners can take with them to be more sustainable in their daily lives?
I think it's important to start small. I think just start with one thing, like one habit that you want to change and then try to stick with that habit, like the paper towel effect I was telling you about before. If you're using paper towels, start with that today. Why not? Picking one thing and then sticking with it becomes really empowering. And then it leads to the next thing. For me, I've been trying to we order takeout from the same place a lot of times. And we started saving all of the utensils and things they gave us to give back to them. So now they're in the habit of taking them. I started taking them out in the restaurant and handing them back to them in the restaurant. So now they're getting used to just taking them out when they see it's us. So, you know, I'm like, okay, these little habits are like slowly growing, one little thing at a time, like just being aware what materials we're gathering unintentionally and allowing to come into our life unintentionally, and then start changing those right away. Start getting to know where your clothes are coming from is a really important thing too. And, you know, to me, it's like clothing is a potential for storytelling, and repairing things and mending things is storytelling to me. You can do really beautiful things with that. And you could even repair or mend a hole on your jeans with, say, the cut off bottom of my son's jeans from when he grew out of them and I had to turn them into shorts. And now I've attached that little bit of clothing from when he was a toddler to my jacket and started telling a story with that.
Yeah. Wow.
Change the way that you think about it and into a more holistic manner, and it'll start to change your consuming habits immediately.
I could talk for so much longer. So great chatting with you.
Gosh, yeah. Come by the shop sometime. Great talking to you. Thank you so much for doing this podcast and for trying to give people other hopeful ways that they can make small changes, because we can all make small changes that make big impacts. Planting seeds. We're planting seeds all around.
Let's keep going.
Have a good one.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
I learned so much from talking with Erin, and quick update, I was able to do some organic t-shirt dyeing at one of her holiday pop-ups here in LA a few days ago. It was a blast. The patterns and colors that came out of the natural materials she had set up to dye with, like yellow onion, eucalyptus, and iron, came out so beautifully, and now I have a new favorite shirt. Thanks, Erin. If you're in LA, I highly recommend going to say hi to Erin and Dennis at their shop or at one of their upcoming pop-ups. And if you're curious about dyeing your own clothes, bags, rags, anything, to give them a second life, follow Erin's pro tips in our episode and get creative. Erin encourages all of us to start doing one more sustainable thing today. Maybe it's eliminating paper towels from your life or bringing your own Tupperware with you when you're ordering takeout from a restaurant. I have eliminated paper towels. I said goodbye to them a few years ago, and Erin is right. I can't tell you how liberating it is not to have to buy those huge rolls of paper towels anymore. Just like Erin, we all need to pave our own path and find our own passions and creativity in life. Let's reflect from this episode and think about how we're paving our own paths to find our creativity, or how we're already living the dream right now. Let's keep going in this creative journey together.